When you think of copper, do you think of something that you would call plastic? Or do you think of a material that squirts? Well, after today, you might. Stay tuned. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art. Good afternoon. I am Chrissy Hewitt, and my co-host, Stephen DeLuque, and I produce this program here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Twice a month, we explore the world of the visual arts. Today's guest is Charles Luton Brain, a metalsmith who was born in England and currently resides in Canada. I met up with Charles last spring at the National Metalsmithing Conference that was held in Tucson, Arizona. Our paths have crossed many times over the years, and he has become quite well known for his explorations in a discipline that he has titled fold forming. I encourage you, if you're near a computer, to go to his website, Charles Luton Brain, LewtonBrain, so that you can have a look at this work. To some degree, you can think about folding paper, making creases, and unfolding it again. But metal does work differently, and copper, because of its high malleability, works quite differently than many other metals. Here now is Charles Luton Brain. Hello.
Hi there.
Let's give a little history about you. Where'd you grow up?
Well, I was born in London, England, and I grew up in Tanzania until I was about 12. And then I moved to the States and lived in Syracuse and later on New Paltz in upstate New York, finally going off to Canada when I was around 18.
And that's home now?
Yes, yeah.
And during that childhood, do you feel that that was the time that shaped some of who you are now in terms of your creative energies?
Yes. My first language was actually Swahili, although I don't really speak it anymore. I lost it as a child. I'm pretty sure that being in other cultures and other languages in particular alters your brain's wiring in some manner, slightly. That's why I think it's good for people to speak several languages.
I could only wish that I could do that. It never quite seems to work. And when did you discover an interest in creating things?
As a child, definitely headed for art school. So there was a definite trend. When I was 16, I would drive to school in my extremely rusty Karmann Ghia and paid for gas by drawing ads for the local independent newspaper.
Huh. That isn't quite where I maybe thought it would have all started. So let's get down to basics in terms of where you are now, somebody who has become quite recognized in the metalsmithing field as doing what we call fold forming. You want to explain that?
Sure. Fold forming's a compositional system of working sheet metals where you fold the metal, you forge it, you work on it. The metal works like clay. It squirts. It's very plastic. And then it is softened, annealed, and opened. When you work it this way, natural shapes and forms emerge, and it echoes and models nature very precisely. I've consulted with biologists on this, morphologists, that is, biologists specializing in shape. And they completely agree that that's precisely what's happening. The shapes are very beautiful, and part of the premise is that if you let nature do the work, it's prettier than if you force the material into a form that is dictated by pen and paper.
Okay, so in terms of an audience having some more visual sense of what's going on, if they had a piece of paper in their hand, it won't work the same. But you could fold paper in many of the same ways that you could fold a thin sheet of copper.
Yes, you can fold paper. And in fact, one of the branches of fold forming is called scoring and bending. And in that branch, you can absolutely do anything you've seen in paper, particularly if you've seen like Japanese animal masks and things. But most fold forming involves plastic use. And so in your mind, think of metal as clay or pastry and everything you know about those materials. It's identical in metal.
I'm going to go back to the use of the word plastic because you started using that in the beginning, and I think a great many people, when they hear that word, think of something rigid. So can we go back to a different definition, or actually maybe the original definition of plastic?
In this case, in this context, plastic means bubblegum, clay, something that is easily deformable, mushable, stretchable. And that's the way in which I'm using it.
I think it's just an interesting clarification for people.
In terms of shapes, if you think of a large leaf, a palm leaf, or a ram's horn, or a seashell, all of those are some of the shapes that emerge from fold forming. Extremely organic and very fast, which is proof as well of working with the laws of nature. The shapes that nature produces are called low-energy, high-entropy form. And what that means is that when nature does anything, whether it's your nose, your ears, a leaf, a bug, nature doesn't waste a calorie. It chooses the least possible energy as a way of creating a form, and that's why everything looks the way it does. And in fold forming, you get the same shapes, and they're quick, and to me that's proof positive that that's exactly what's happening.
That's really cool, because even though I had the pleasure of taking your workshop and experiencing this particular process firsthand, I've also learned for myself that if I'm just forging a piece of thick silver or copper wire or whatever, that I might pre-bend it a little bit if I chose. But if I come back in and actually hit it with a metal hammer against a steel surface and therefore it begins to thin out, that shape is more beautiful. That curve has a whole different look in the end than if I just arbitrarily bend it.
For instance, if you take a rod of, in our case metal, but it could be fiberglass or something, and you were to grab it by the ends and bend it, the curve in the middle will be specific to each type of material. So copper would give you one curve, or copper that's been worked so it's hard will give you a different quality of curve, steel different, gold different, etc., etc. But in each case, the actual curve will be perfect in some way, and yet you didn't touch it, yet you didn't actually do anything to that particular part of the material to obtain that curve. So the premise is, if you let the material dictate the form, and it's bounded by the rules of nature, by that I mean things like surface tension and gravity and how materials stretch and so on, it's going to be pretty. And it's going to be prettier than if you did it with pliers. And it's also way faster if you let it do the work.
That certainly was evidenced in the number of pieces that we, the class, were able to pound out in a matter of hours. And as metalsmiths, that's not a common occurrence for most of us.
No. One of my favorite ones is kind of hard to visualize, but let's see if we can have a shot at it. You take a square, and you can try this with paper. You take a square, and you fold it corner to corner, so it's a triangle. And then you fold it again, corner to corner, so you now have a smaller triangle. And on one side of it, there are all fold edges, and on the other side, it's the ends of the sheet. And then you put it through a rolling mill. And a rolling mill is kind of like a pasta maker for metal. And it squishes it, and it rolls it out, just as if you were rolling pastry, phyllo, perhaps, with a rolling pin. And so you roll this thing out, and it stretches about three times more than it started with. And then you anneal it, soften it, and open it up, and you have a cup. And it's a cup with no seams. And it'll work in clay or pastry. You just have to find a way to get the layers not to stick together, flour perhaps, and you could get the same thing. But I like that one. You can do it in just a couple of minutes. by hand. And for regular trade goldsmiths, it's magic. They turn it around looking for the joins. Where's the joint? There is no join. You've just sort of brought this flower-like shape, this hollow cup, to being.
Yes, I tried one of those, and it has been fun handing it to people, and they do enjoy it. We've used the term annealing.
Yes. Annealing is to use heat to take a metal to just below a dull red color. Usually, it is then cooled quickly, and at this point, it is as soft as it's going to get, which means that if you work metals, every time you hit it, for instance, or bend it, it gets harder, you can reset that. You can make it as soft as many times as you like, which is how silversmiths can take a flat disc of metal and shape it into a hollow in a piece of wood using hammers, creating a bowl-like shape. And as it gets hard from doing that, you anneal it again, you heat it again, and it's as soft as possible. And eventually, by repeating hammering and working, you can end up with a bottle in metal. That's pretty wild. That's pretty magic.
It is. Every time I raise a piece, I often find myself standing at the sink, filling it up with water, and then just sort of amazed that, boy, this was flat, and now it isn't.
And in fact, that is something that brings many people into the metals and jewelry field. You ask them, why do you do this? And one of the things that most will say is metamorphosis, the change of something flat into something fully three-dimensional. Transformation, that's what turns people on.
Yes, because in general, it's not as instant a material as clay or even glass blowing, where you can stand mesmerized watching somebody produce something. But the fold forming comes the closest, I think.
Yeah, I think it does.
At least in terms of people physically working the material.
Yes, in terms of instant feedback. If you ever see a film about metalsmithing, let me tell you, they've edited out a few hours before you see it. But in fold forming, it's in real time.
You're listening to Ears on Art, here on listener-supported KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. This program is part of Issues and Ideas and comes to you the first and second Wednesday of the month. Our guest today is Charles Luton Brain, a longtime metalsmith who has made a career out of discovering what happens when you fold, bend, and hammer metal, and then open it up again. I am Chrissy Hewitt, and I continue my conversation now with Charles as he discusses the unique education opportunity that he had in Germany. How did you first stumble onto this?
I went to art college. I chose jewelry as a subject there, and my teacher, whose name was Christian Gaudernack, he was a fifth-generation jeweler from Norway who happened to be teaching in Nova Scotia, where I went to school. And he had studied at a college in Germany in a town called Pforzheim. He told me to go there, so I did. This particular school had been incredibly influential through the 60s and 70s, and you can go to any country in the world and find pretty well-known people who went to this school. However, the Germans had changed the school system since my teacher went, and when he went, 85% of the students were visiting students. That is, they'd already finished their master's, and they went there to study. Only 15% of students in the old days actually cared about a piece of paper. The Germans changed the school system, and they made it so that, first of all, you couldn't teach if you didn't have a high school diploma, and so they therefore fired most of their technical staff. They also made it so you couldn't get into the art school, which is part of the university system, unless you had a high school diploma, thus preventing anybody with any skill from attending. Because in Germany, when you were 15, you made a choice. Either you finished high school or you went and did an apprenticeship. So overnight, the student population changed. About 10 years later, they realized this was a really dim move, and they backed off on those rules. However, that's what I landed in. Essentially, what it meant was that you went from working class, proletariat type working people to upper middle class rich kids who had no technical skill whatsoever. So the student population changed dramatically. To compensate for this change, first of all, they instituted a 2-year technical training program in jewelry making to teach the basics, which really doesn't get you that far. And then you finally got to study with the main teachers. And in my case, that was a guy named Klaus Ulrich. There was another one named Reinhold Reiling. So I jumped in at that point as a visiting student. Ulrich and Reiling, during the 1950s and early 60s, had been revolutionaries in their own way. And these days it seems kind of old hat. But back then, what they did was they took fused metal, that is, they fried it. They chopped it up. They did nasty things to it. And they said, this is beautiful. And they made jewelry out of it. Fine jewelry, gold, diamonds, etc. Which at the time was a kind of in-your-face behavior to the rest of the field. And the most important thing Ulrich taught me was that the marks of process are compositional elements. Now what that means is, if I have a piece of metal and I pick up a file and I file it, the mark that's left by filing is a design choice. So I wasn't just taking stuff off to get somewhere else. I just made a visual compositional choice by touching it with a file. If I hit it with a hammer, I'm not merely squishing it to change its shape, but that mark, I just made a design choice. And so this brings you to a place where every mark you make is conscious and on purpose. The byproduct of this is that you can make stuff twice or three times faster than the regular jeweler who makes marks and then has to spend time removing them. So that was the beginning. So he would take the students, and for the first 6 to 8 weeks, you were forced to play with the material. You were not allowed to make any objects, which was kind of puzzling for me after I'd finished my degree and everything. Okay, all right, I'll do what you say. Besides, I couldn't speak German that well at that point. And after about 6 to 8 weeks, everybody would have a vocabulary of things they could do. If I bend it this way and hit it this way and hit it with a torch so it wrinkles on the surface, it looks like this. Each person's vocabulary of things they could do to the metal were pretty. And each person's vocabulary was completely different. Everybody would have 6 or 7 things that they could repeat. I have a friend. And they said, if you make a mistake 3 times, it's a technique. So this has to do with that. If it looks pretty, can you do it again? And this brings up an old joke between the difference between an artist and a craftsperson. An artist can make an exquisite, beautiful, lovely object, and a craftsperson can make 2 of them. At the end of 6 weeks, you started to play with design, and now you got to making jewelry with it, and basically it continued. Part of the spectrum of experiments I did had to do with folding, and that's how it began.
Now it's 30-plus years later, thereabouts?
That's right. And actually, last week, I presented a paper to the Santa Fe Symposium, which is the world scientific conference for the jewelry industry. You know, it's the place where the technologies of the future are here today. 30% of the presentations at this conference were all about direct computer printing in metals, like in gold and titanium and stainless. So that was really interesting to me, that the world of industry and the world of science wanted to hear about fold forming.
That is really neat. And I imagine that they were fairly amazed when they started seeing the forms.
Yes, the room was so quiet I thought I was bombing, and then afterwards I found out it was just that everybody was fascinated.
One of the things that I found really intriguing was in working with copper, you're folding it and heating it and then opening it up and seeing different colors. For a lot of us, that process of trying to get color on copper has always been kind of a mystery in terms of how do I have any control over it. And it was really interesting that when it was folded, something different happens.
Yes, absolutely. Basically, when you heat copper, you have two copper oxides that are produced. One of them is red and one of them is black. If you have a folded object and you heat it, at the very edge you'll have a border, a rim of black, which is where more oxygen could get into that fold when you are heating it. And then a little bit further inside that, you'll have another border of red, red-purplish color, which is the secondary oxide, which is where there's less oxygen. And then further in, there's nothing. It's oxygen-free inside the package, which is normally not an issue, but sometimes can be a problem. You can actually weld the metal if you get it too hot or do something else.
But that lack of oxygen and giving us that cleaner, more copper color, and so when we go back to that folded piece that opens up to a seamless vessel, then you've got that dark rim, the reddish color, and then copper, which really intensifies, I think, the beauty of that form.
Yes, absolutely. In most natural objects, on the edges of things like leaves and so on, basically you get more chemical action on the edges of things in nature. And so once more, the way these objects are colored echoes what actually happens in nature. Part of the premise is that makes it prettier.
What do you do for preserving that, or do you worry about it?
You can use waxes of all types. I generally just let them go, but they will go brown. Oh, there's all sorts of ways of stopping it. Many options.
So these days you're teaching, have been for some time, right?
Yes, that's right. I'm a program head of a jewelry program at the Alberta College of Art and Design in Calgary, Canada.
Describe some of the curriculum that your students get to enjoy.
Our particular program is a little unusual for an art college. We spend a fair bit of time on technique, but the technical is actually seen as kind of metaphors for project management, and we explain it that way, and we accept a wide spectrum of practice. One of the things about the metalsmithing or jewelry world is, first of all, it's old. Everybody does it. Everybody wants it. The other thing is it's wide. So I could choose, as an art jeweler, to work in beams of light, and that would be perfectly acceptable. Or I could choose to set diamonds into high carat golds and platinum. And in our program, that's our position. Everybody has a grounding, but then by the last year, you're free. We had one student who graduated who was doing 40 by 30 foot wall pictures using roadkill in colored photocopies, arranged so prettily that you didn't realize what it was for a while. And he went off and got all kinds of, you know, scholarships and master's degrees and things like that. And of course, we have people who become jewelers.
And how long a program is it?
It's a standard 4-year art college program. So in the first year, exploration year, and you get to take a number of courses in different areas, and then the actual program itself, resulting in a focused degree, is the following 3 years.
And you've been there how long?
Longer than my students have been born, since 86.
I was starting to find that situation too when I left, and it's a little strange.
I think one's mind sort of stays at a younger point. I remember asking a 92-year-old woman once how old she was, and she said she was 17 in her head.
Where is fold forming going for you?
Well, first of all, I have some catch-up to do. There's a very long overdue CD-ROM which needs finishing off with thousands and thousands of pictures on it. There is beginning to be organizations based around fold forming in upstate New York. I've been teaching at a place called the Center for Metal Arts for several years, and they've started calling this event a fold forming symposium, and so the fifth year is coming up. At this point, people are constructing other things that are spinning off it.
And as you continue to do it, are you finding new forms very often?
Well, I don't really have that much time to do that. In fact, the workshops that I've taught over the years, over 200 of them, they were kind of informal research labs where people would present new ideas and I could kind of respond to them and take them further. And I know hundreds of shapes, but I believe I've seen between 3% and 5% of the possibilities. And any time that I seriously go into the workshop, I would say within 15 minutes you're going new places. A lot of variation possible out there. The whole metals field is like that. You'll never learn it all. I was talking to a goldsmith the other day, and he studied with a German master. He had done something particular, and he was proud of it, and he took it to the master, and the master said, that's nice. He said, that's good. But he said, do you see this brick wall? And he pointed to a huge, long wall full of bricks. And the student said, yes. And he said, you see these three bricks? And this is a master goldsmith. He said, I know that much. And all the rest of it is the metals world. And he said, you see this speck on this brick? That's how much you know. And the student, rather than taking it aback, instead understood that it's that big. You'll never know it all. And that's the beauty of this field.
I believe you've even alluded to already that process in and of itself is a real pleasure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Fold forming and the other research that I've done over the years, and patinas and applying gold to surfaces and welding stainless steel and growing metal on it, all of it has been about drawing. I started out as an illustrator, as a drawer, and so my entire focus has been on how do I draw with these materials, and that has to do with process and feedback and watching it so you can figure out what things to use. I'll give you a small example for patinas. If anything is really hard to clean, like in your kitchen, that's an excellent metal patina. The burnt on oil on the cookie sheet, that's perfect, perfect stuff. So a lot of this is a matter of being observant.
So true. Well, Charles, I really appreciate your taking some time and sharing your world with us. You're in one little tiny part of it, but you've made a pretty big impression.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. Yeah, it's a pleasure.
We often think that the interview has come to its conclusion until we remember to ask, is there anything we didn't talk about? Here is that item.
This year, I did win Canada's most important award in the visual arts, which was exciting and a pleasure. And for me, the most rewarding part of that experience was that they changed the final question in the competition in the jury. And I've sat in that jury room in the past. It's very tough. And so the final question now is, if this person had never existed, would the field still be the same? And for me, that was the most rewarding part of the entire experience, that my efforts had changed things.
That was internationally recognized metalsmith Charles Luton Brain. And I certainly encourage you to go to his website. His last name is Luton, LewtonBrain. And you can see many, many images of fold forming. You have been listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. Stephen DeLuque and I will be back next week with a program about a local artist who works in fiber and pastel. I'm Chrissy Hewitt. Thank you so much for listening.